are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
You won't have escaped your notice that that's a rag tune from the era about which we're going to talk a bit later today. My opening words are, in fact, from Catherine Helen Spence. She wrote this on hearing Martha Turner preach. Now, Martha Turner was the minister of the Melbourne Unitarian Church, who actually exchanged pulpits with my great-grandfather back in 1874 or thereabouts. And Catherine Helen Spence found her quite inspiring. And she wrote, "When I heard a highly intelligent and exceptionally able woman conducting the services all through, and especially reading the scriptures of the Old and New Testament with such intelligence that they seemed to take on new meaning, I felt how much the world had been losing for so many centuries." So welcome to the service. My name's Peter Whitten, but you all know that anyway. I've been a member of the congregation for a couple of years. But I welcome you to this morning's service, and on behalf of the many Unitarians who've worshipped in South Australia since 1854. We have an acknowledgement of the Kaurna people whose land we meet on. I won't attempt to read the actual Kaurna. I'm sure I wouldn't get the pronunciation correctly.
This reading is from Unbridling the Tongues of Women by Susan McGarry. The suffrage campaign's growing strength proved irresistible. She attended a meeting of the Women's Suffrage League for the first time in 1891. The suffragists must have been pleased to have won such a prize. They invited her to preside over the meeting. By May of that year, she had agreed to become one of the League's vice presidents, and in June, she joined the deputation from the League to the Premier, Thomas Playford. In May 1892, her address to the League's annual meeting won her applause as enthusiastic as any that she encountered in her campaign for effective voting. In July of that year, she led another female suffrage deputation to the government. She was hooked. She told a drawing room meeting in December 1892, "The women's suffrage movement in this province has become too strong for me to keep outside of it any longer. I must take hold of it and endeavour to guide it somewhat." That report suggests some measure of Spence's charisma, for the record reports only delight in Spence's support. She did not attempt to direct or even guide the suffrage campaign. Rather, she offered it substantial support. She agreed to urge the Women's Suffrage League's interest during her effective voting campaign, and the League authorised her to enrol members and collect subscriptions. She was a powerful recruit. No other woman in South Australia could justly so assert, as she did, that she had taken her full share in colonial life, and that Australian politics were the very breath of her nostrils. Parliamentarians referred to her as a well-known authority on political subjects and averred that she had an acquaintance with the principles of government that few men could claim to attain. The press stood solidly behind her, and in April 1893, the Advertiser remarked that Miss Spence's arguments are thoughtful and sober, and her language entirely free from the screeching hysteria that has so often brought ridicule and contempt on the cause of women's rights.
Thank you, Helen. Now, just have a couple of minutes of silent meditation. Thank you, Grant and Brendan. That's great. Most appropriate for the theme today. Australian author Miles Franklin, she of the well-regarded literary awards, dubbed her the greatest Australian woman. Others referred to her as the grand old woman of Australia. The subject of these accolades was, of course, Catherine Helen Spence. Novelist, journalist, social reformer, political activist, and preacher. A most remarkable woman, she devoted her life to the struggle against the constraints which Victorian society imposed upon women. She was a leader in the women's suffrage movement, which eventually succeeded in not only winning the vote for women, but also the right to stand for political office, and which she did herself, albeit unsuccessfully. And South Australia was the leader in that effort there, led all the other colonies except for Western Australia, I think. Miss Spence was an active and leading member of the Adelaide Unitarian Congregation, which she had joined in her 30s, forsaking the stern Calvinistic religion of her upbringing. She died in 1910, and I would like to examine how Unitarianism, especially the local variety of Unitarianism, has progressed from that time to the present day. Perhaps we can then draw some conclusions about what she would make of present-day Unitarian thought and practice. In particular, I shall discuss developments in both the Melbourne and Adelaide Unitarian churches. The Unitarianism that Catherine Helen Spence would have experienced and had been comfortable with was very much Christian-oriented. The preface to a Book of Common Prayer, published by the Adelaide Unitarian Christian Church in 1869, says, among other things, "Esteeming the formal profession of a creed to be not only not essential to worship, but rather alien in its spirit, the compilers of this volume have endeavoured to frame a liturgy which all Christians can join without reservation or offence, although they are, of course, aware that it must needs fall short of fully satisfying their brethren of other churches, who add to the Spirit of the Heavenly Father the offering of prayer and praise to the Son and the Holy Spirit as the second and third persons of a triune God." The preface goes on, "They," that is the compilers, "have also striven to avoid all expressions which would seem, even by implication, to narrow the ground upon which they and their fellow worshippers, although differing maybe on other minor points, meet together week by week as disciples of Jesus Christ to offer prayer and praise to him whom they regard as the sole object of worship, the one true God." Thus the Unitarians of the latter years of the 19th century, rejecting the Trinity, nevertheless saw themselves as enlightened Christians, not as worshippers of Christ, but as followers or disciples of Jesus, the great teacher. This then was the essence of the Unitarianism of Catherine Helen Spence. She believed that God is one, and therefore Jesus, however great a person, was by no means divine. I must say, however, that given the basic tenets of Unitarianism, i.e. freedom of religious belief for the individual, putting our beliefs to the test of reason and responsibility, and not least a tolerance of or respect for the beliefs of others, it is a little dangerous to reach conclusions based on generalisations about the religious views of Unitarians, a case of all generalisations being dangerous, even this one. Having said that, I will make the general observation that where two Unitarians are gathered together, there will be inevitably debate, nor at least discussion. Notwithstanding the principle of tolerance, there might even be heated argument. Two old stories come to mind. In the first story, a Unitarian is walking along a road. She comes to a fork in the road where there is a sign which says, "To heaven," pointing down one way, and the sign says, "To a discussion about heaven." The Unitarian, unable to turn up the opportunity for a good religious discussion, chooses the latter road. The second story concerns two men who are arrested on a street corner for fighting. The magistrate dealing with the case says, "What are you fighting about?" "Religion, your worship." Addressing the first man, the magistrate asks, "What religion are you?" Unitarian, Your Worship. To the other he asked, what about you? Unitarian, Your Worship. Some contemporary Christians have begun to liberalise their views on certain previously held beliefs, such as the virgin birth, original sin, and the resurrection, as expounded by Orthodox Christianity over the centuries. The late Dr. Spong, for example. In this connection, it's notable that the installation of the Reverend Dr. Mark Ahlstrom as minister of our church in the late 1990s was attended by a representative from the Jesuits of St. Ignatius just up the road in Nord. Bearing in mind that it was the Jesuits who forced the Socinians, i.e. the people who sort of started the Unitarian movement, out of Poland in the 16th century. As you know, we have in recent years had a number of pulpit exchanges with other churches, mostly with ministers from the Uniting Church, not to mention our annual multi-faith service, where representatives from outside the Christian mainstream have felt welcomed. However, it's apparent that such liberality is still far from universal within many of the mainstream Christian churches, let alone some fundamentalists. Until comparatively recent years, our Unitarian ministers in Adelaide had met opposition from a number of ministers of other denominations when attempting to join the local ministers' fraternal. In the meantime, Unitarian thought has moved on, although the central tenets of Unitarianism, freedom, reason, and tolerance, have not changed. The century since Catherine Helen Spence preached from the pulpit of the Adelaide Church has seen incredible development in scientific knowledge, discovery, and the advancement of scholarship. Human knowledge has expanded at a rate unprecedented in history. How have Unitarians applied these advances in science, philosophy, medicine, education, economics, and social development? The answer to that question will vary according to the particular Unitarian church you might be visiting. It's fair to say, however, that the free faith of Unitarianism, or in the United States, Unitarian Universalism, has expanded to embrace a concept of unity in diversity. That is to say, there's a broad range of beliefs within any given group of adherents. But notwithstanding my story of the bellicose Unitarians, there's generally an acknowledgement of and a respect for that diversity. As we say, we believe there are many paths to truth, that all religions and philosophies have something to offer us, but no one belief or philosophy has a complete answer. Indeed, doubters from way back, we are highly sceptical of those who claim to hold all knowledge and wisdom. Come to this church and have your answers questioned is a statement which would ring bells in many Unitarian churches. Now, some churches and groups have moved further than others. Almost from inception, the Melbourne Unitarians, for example, were heavily and prominently involved in debates over the significant political and religious issues of the day. In the 1870s, Martha and Giles Turner, Martha being the first female Unitarian minister in Australia who inspired Catherine Helen Spence, as I mentioned, were identified in Victoria with the Sunday Liberation Society, which campaigned to have public transport and cultural activities allowed on the Sabbath. Since then, Melbourne Unitarians have tended, in Dorothy Scott's words, to confuse religion and socio-political liberalism, so much so that under the leadership of the Reverend Victor James in the 1940s and 50s, the Melbourne Church, or the members who remained after the schism of 1949, removed the benediction and religious content generally from their services. Hymns were replaced by ethical or humanist songs of freedom. If you go to a service in East Melbourne today, you'll find that it's more often than not conducted along the lines of a political meeting rather than a recognisable service of worship. Just have a word with Margaret Lambert sometime, she'll tell you all about that. Here in Adelaide, we haven't moved quite as far as our Melbourne brethren. However, here, as in the majority of churches in the USA and Great Britain, we have seen a definite trend towards religious humanism. It will have not escaped your notice that I referred to the Adelaide Unitarian Christian Church publishing a Book of Common Prayer in 1869. Just over 100 years later, we, the Adelaide congregation, resolved to have the word Christian removed from our official title. A survey of our congregation taken a few years ago revealed that 41% of respondents saw themselves as humanists, whereas only 26% saw themselves as Christians in their belief. Now, what could be the reason for the movement to the theological left? Many of us have come from other churches, predominantly the Uniting Church or its constituent forebears, although I think we have a few recalcitrant Baptists and Catholics. Sorry, John. We also have several who have been described by our Minister Emeritus, Reverend Alan Kirby, who has a way with words, as congenital Unitarians. That is to say, they were brought up in the church. In fact, there are several founding or early member families of the church still represented by present members of the congregation, or at least up until reasonably recently. Those of us who have come from other churches have frequently expressed relief that our church does not expect any statement of belief or faith or adherence to any creed or doctrine, especially as such statements, for example, the Nicene Creed, seem to demand belief in the unbelievable. Unitarianism would say that beliefs which have been arrived at by a contemporary person carry just as much validity as those formulated in ancient times by people such as the assembled bishops in Nicaea in 325 AD, whose knowledge of the world and the universe was, without the benefit of modern education, very limited. Moreover, we subscribe to the idea that truth is a growing, unfolding thing, which perhaps is never, ever fully known or understood. Between the time of Miss Spence's death and 1984, our church has been served by seven ministers, the longest serving being George Hale from 1921 to 1945. All but one originated from Britain. It's probably fair to say that most of them had a conservative approach to religion, by current Unitarian measures anyway. Our Minister Emeritus, Alan Kirby, took the pulpit in 1968 and was a prime mover in the relocation of our church from Wakefield Street to this current site here in 1971. Alan, a product of the Unitarian College Manchester, probably became more liberal as his ministry went on. His services were characterised by readings more often than not from Buddhism, Emerson, Tillich, Tagore, Gibran, or other non-biblical writings. Sermons were hardly ever based on biblical texts. My opinion is that Alan's influence moved the Adelaide church body a considerable way along the theological spectrum. On Alan's resignation in 1984, the Adelaide church embarked on a series of interim ministries. From looking only to our traditional British roots, we now were receiving ideas and support from the American Unitarian Universalist Association. From 84 to 88, when we appointed Eric Heller Wagner our next settled minister, 13 ministers came to intern to Adelaide on an average of 3 months each. All but one of these were from the United States. And then after Eric resigned, we reactivated the program in between further settled ministers' appointments. Several of these ministers were female at a time when the ordination of women was still a controversial topic among Anglicans and to a certain extent some Uniting Church congregations. The effect on this congregation was quite dramatic. From a period of isolation, geographically and theologically speaking, we experienced a wide range of styles and ideas within a short period of time. And since the early 1990s, we've had visits from several more overseas ministers. My observation was that the movement towards humanism was accelerated as these ministers, Sunday by Sunday, gave us the benefit of their many years in the pulpit and their working with diverse groups of people. Many had come from the breeding grounds of Unitarian thought, the home territory of people like Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, William Ellery Channing, and Theodore Parker, that hotbed of Unitarianism, New England. They had also experienced the merger in 1961 of Unitarians and Universalists. The latter body had been founded in the 18th century by John Murray, who, like Catherine Helen Spence a century later, had rejected the stern Calvinistic God of his youth in favour of a God of love and compassion. Our church members have always been very much involved in community activities and causes for social improvement. Church members have been, and many still are, involved in such organisations as Travellers Aid, Meals on Wheels, the War Widows Guild, Friends of the Botanic Gardens, Friends of the Art Gallery, local government, and also the YWCA. But this, until relatively recently, has been purely an individual involvement rather than as activities organised by the church. However, two major trends have started over the past two or three decades. Firstly, a discernible trend in political views, and secondly, a willingness to move the church towards involving itself as a body in community activities. Historian Dr. David Hilliard, in a paper presented to the State Library in 2004, observed that the liberal theology of the church did not seem to translate into political liberalism, and this has been by and large true up until relatively recent times. However, over the past two decades, we've had an influx of new members who, while by no means radical, would definitely not identify with the conservative side of politics. And so several years ago, the Unitarians for Refugees group was formed. With their support of the Committee of Management, this group pursued a very active program of teaching English to former asylum seekers, mainly Afghani, supporting them in finding jobs and helping them in their quest for refugee status. Mind you, some of this work goes back a bit further than that, to the 70s, when our church members were active in assisting several Vietnamese families with accommodation, English language skills, and general support. These activities have now been subsumed into our outreach program. Many of us have taken part in various protests as a church group, for example, marching to oppose the Iraqi war back in 2003, as well as more recent weekly vigils at Parliament House in support of refugees. Now, what would Catherine Helen Spence have made of all of that? Very dangerous, I think, to put yourself in another's shoes and attempt to speak for him or her. We are products of different ages, backgrounds, and cultures. However, I think it's obvious that Miss Spence was a person with an inquiring mind who was prepared to move to the edge when it came to social norms and political activism. For example, I quote from Helen Thompson's preface to the 1984 Penguin edition of Miss Spence's novel, Handfasted. I should say that the manuscript was rejected by the publisher when it was first submitted. Thompson writes that the rejection of the manuscript on the grounds that it was calculated to loosen the marriage tie, it was too socialistic and consequently dangerous, tells us something about Miss Spence's radicalism relative to the prevailing mores governing fiction. Thompson goes on, from a masculine conservative point of view, Handfasted in 1879 raised potentially subversive ideas. And of course the ideas presented in that novel, trial marriage or just living together, would raise few eyebrows today. As I've mentioned, Miss Spence was a vocal advocate for female suffrage and strongly pushed for improvements in the voting system, speaking at political gatherings not only in Australia but in the United States and also Great Britain. She was successful in persuading the South Australian colonial government to allow women to actually stand for election, the first of the Australian colonies to do so. We take this for granted today, but it was radical political stuff in the 1890s. Witness the trials of the suffragette movement in Britain in the first two decades of the 20th century. And women in Britain didn't get the vote until, I think, about 1928. It was something of that about that time. Catherine Helen Spence would appreciate members of her church, humanist or otherwise, working to help refugees by teaching English and supporting them in their quest for some sort of status in the face of mean and rigid government policy. This is very much in line with her work for those who didn't have a voice in her contemporary world, women, orphans and children. I believe that this work with refugees is exactly the sort of activity which she would involve herself in. Not only that, but I can see her being very vocal in leading agitation for changes to government policy in this area. Prout and Feely, in their book Petticoat Pioneers, have this to say. And still she continued to shock conservative elements in South Australian society. Embarking on a career of lecturing, she spoke on social questions both in Australia and the United States. This was a most unusual venture for a woman in the 19th century. And to top it all, she invaded another male field and began to write her sermons, some of which she delivered in churches in Adelaide, Sydney and Melbourne, speaking in Unitarian churches, apparently the first to allow women to preach. In short, she put into practical action the views of Samuel Taylor Coleridge that radicalism in politics and rationalism in religion go hand in hand. Over the past few decades, our congregation has sought to stimulate public thought through the weekly program Expanding Horizons, and a number of you have been heavily involved in that program. The program is no longer broadcast, sadly, but recordings we still have recordings, and they're available on request from the church office. The aim of the series was not to proselytise, but to canvass ideas on ethics, philosophy, religion, and day-to-day concerns of ordinary people. I believe that as a pioneer woman preacher, Catherine would have embraced that sort of technology to get her message across to as wide an audience as possible. We have, week by week, collected offerings of food for the Magdalen Centre to help feed homeless people in the city. Some of our members have, until regulations intervene, regularly worked with St Vincent de Paul's outreach, cooking for the homeless. Miss Spence would find that there are still individual members contributing their time and expertise in leadership roles within community organisations, as she did. And she would find congregational members, female and male, who, when called upon, are prepared to conduct a service of worship or give an address from the pulpit, as she did in her day. In fact, she would find that the governing body of the church, the 11-member Committee of Management, was, until our last AGM at any rate, made up of a majority of female members, as has more often than not been the case over the past few years. Prout and Feely again. Such was Catherine Helen Spence, surely one of the most versatile and talented women of her generation. She was always ready to consider new ideas and theories in every field of human endeavour. She appreciated to the full the fact that she was living in changing and stirring times, an era that was shrugging off much of the old and worn-out values. We live in times which are no less changing and stirring. We, the members of this Unitarian Church, small in number, I believe, see ourselves as continuing the tradition of enlightened practical religion which Catherine Helen Spence so ably demonstrated. Closing words. As a preliminary to that, I'd like to say that Catherine Helen Spence joined the Unitarian Church when in her 30s, having rejected the stern Calvinistic doctrines of the Presbyterian Church of her upbringing. Many years later, she wrote to Crawford Woods' third wife, "No one owes more to your dear husband than I do. The dark pall which enveloped heaven and earth was lifted. The confused conscience was made clear and straight. The rebellious heart was made submissive and contented under his ministrations. I have been a more cheerful person ever since, more comfortable to my friends and more serviceable to the world."
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitariansa@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians. Thank you.
Thank you.